From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a road funding bill sails through the legislature. So why did Governor Snyder veto it?
As it does deal with money. And as we know, the number one priority of the Snyder administration is budgeting and finances.
And we'll dig more into the widening rift between the governor and attorney general, including that Flint water probe.
The optics alone really suggests that the governor's lawyers may be trying to hide something.
Honoring battle flags carried by Michigan Civil War troops.
If we were to restore the flag, that would literally mean sewing up bullet holes, saber slashes, washing the blood off some of the flags.
And a playscape that will bring autistic children into the world of play. Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a playscape made of special fabric producing different sensations, all designed to bring autistic kids into the world of play.
So there's an opportunity to interact with the screen and then produce some type of feedback, which I think is going to be really, really satisfying for these children interacting with the screen.
That will be later in the program. But first, while many of us were getting ready for our holiday weekend last Friday afternoon, Governor Snyder announced his veto of a road funding bill that would have given some financial relief to 45 large cities. Senate Bill 557 was sponsored by Republican Senator Marty Nolenberg of Troy. It was unanimously approved by the House and the Senate, kind of remarkable in and of itself. It would have repealed a requirement that larger cities pay for part of the state's cost for highway construction projects within their borders. But the governor hauled out his veto power to whack the road bill. Let's talk about what might be going on here as we say hello to Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News Service. Good to have you with us, Zach.
Great to be here. Thanks.
This is an interesting turn, isn't it, in the debate over who's driving the car in Lansing, the governor or the legislature. What are your thoughts?
You know, it was just surprising to see the governor decide to take a stand on this. Now, his Department of Transportation had said it opposed this bill, but when a bill passes unanimously like this, sometimes then the governor says, well, we tried, we didn't win this one, we're going to sign it. But he decided he was going to take a stand on this. You know, the governor for 6 years, really, almost 6 years now, has been pushing for reforming the state's basic road funding formula. And there has really been no interest in the legislature in going down that path. And I think it has frustrated the governor. And as he put it in his veto message, he saw this bill as a piecemeal way of changing the road funding formula and called for, again, an overall look at it.
So he's saying, nah, I want the big change, to change that road funding law, that old one that goes back to 1951.
Right. And the formula has been tweaked over the years. Now, it is a public act from 1951, and it's commonly known around Lansing as PA 51 of 1951. But it has been changed over the years, where 39% of the funding goes to the state, 39% to counties, and the remaining 22% to cities and villages. There's communities that love this formula, and there's communities that don't like it. The divide is pretty much between populous areas, non-populous areas. You know, if you're in a community with big roads that are 4 and 5 lanes on each side, you probably don't like this formula. If you're in a community with a lot of 2-lane roads, you like this formula. It works out well for you.
Well, to that point, Senator Marty Nolenberg's from Troy, and that city's expected to have to pay over $9 million chipping in for that monster billion-dollar state project that we're going to be seeing in years to come to widen I-75 in Oakland County, and Royal Oaks also in his district, and they're supposed to fork over more than $4 million. So there's more than 13 million reasons right there why Senator Nolenberg is saying he feels very furious and very betrayed. What kind of political price might the governor pay for enraging legislators in his own party, making them feel so betrayed?
Well, it's never a good idea to create enemies, and clearly Senator Nolenberg was really agitated about this. He said he didn't see this coming. That is always a concern. And look, it takes 2/3 majorities in the House and Senate to override the governor, and obviously the votes to do that are there. So the governor has gambled here that the leadership in the House and Senate, which is, of course, Republican, being a Republican legislature, would not inflict the indignity of a veto override on him. And maybe they won't. You know, so far, the goal seems to be in the Senate, can we come up with a new bill that placates the governor's concerns and deals with this issue? I'm not sure that there is, unless the governor's willing to just say never mind on the whole idea of his overall road funding formula reform.
What does this episode say to us about Rick Snyder's relationship with the legislature and really about his overall approach to governing and lawmaking?
So one of the big differences with this bill that I think could have prompted the governor's irritation at it is it does deal with money. And as we know, the number one priority of the Snyder administration is budgeting and finances. There's about $4 million a year at stake here over the next 5 years that would come out of the Michigan Department of Transportation's budget to pay for local governments, cities specifically, big cities, no longer having to pay a share of these big state trunk line road projects. And, you know, it does fit into that Snyder dynamic that there's so many things where he will sign and say, well, I wanted to be a good partner with the legislature here, even though I, you know, wasn't a fan of this idea or it wasn't my idea. But you push him on finances or money, and he tends to react much more strongly than he would on other issues. This could be a tipping point. I don't know that it will be, but certainly if the legislature were to override the governor on this, it would just sort of be another sign that the second term seems to be more the legislature driving the agenda.
Zach Gorchow with Gongwer News Service. Always great to get your insights, Zach. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This week, State Attorney General Bill Schuette announced that if Governor Snyder wants to appeal a court decision regarding teacher pay, he'll have to hire his own attorney. The AG is sitting this one out. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here now via Skype as we look at this ever-widening split between Michigan's two top Republicans. And this isn't the first time the attorney general has taken himself off the governor's team, is it? And vice versa.
No, they have kind of a history of backing away from each other. You would think that with the two top Republicans would be lockstep on a lot of issues, from gay marriage to EPA regulations to the gas tax proposed increase that was shot down by voters by a 4-to-1 margin. But the fact is they're not. These guys, they occupy different offices, and they are very different cats politically and in terms of style.
And then, of course, we have the attorney general's probe into Flint water. And here we had Schuette's top investigator, Todd Flood, flat out saying it is the Snyder legal team dragging its feet on handing over requested documents. Where do you see this going?
I suspect that ultimately they're going to get a deal, that they're going to come to an agreement. Because if they don't, I think it's highly likely, if not certain, that the attorney general will file what's called a motion to compel and ask the court to order the governor's lawyers to produce the documents, text messages, emails that they're seeking. At the end of the day, they're going to want to have a consensual deal here, and they're not going to want to have the court involved because the optics alone really suggests that the governor's lawyers may be trying to hide something, which they may not be, but ultimately it certainly sends that message. And I don't think that's a message the governor wants to send.
And they have been clear right from the beginning, have they not, the Schuette team, that no one is exempt. You have said that often as we've talked.
Yeah, and they continue to say that. And, you know, I wouldn't say there's a wink and a nod, but I think there's clearly an effort here to say, look, we are going to go where the evidence leads us. And that's what they should be doing. I don't, however, think you can divorce this from the attorney general's political aspirations, because a lot of these positions that he ends up taking, some of which are opposed to the governor's positions, you could argue all of them have a potential positioning with the electorate, positions that might make them a little bit more popular, that might separate the attorney general from the current Republican administration and the current Republican legislature, which has not been all sweetness and light in terms of some of the positions that they've taken and some of the ways they've managed problems, chiefly the Flint water crisis.
I love the way you put it in today's column that the attorney general is using it to the better to theoretically inoculate his political prospects from Republican complicity in the morass. Nice turn of phrase there.
Well, if you want to use it, yeah, I thought it inoculate. Kind of seemed right, because it's just the disease that you're trying to get away from. And I think he clearly is. And frankly, I think it's going to be tough. I think it's going to be tough for any Republican in 2018 to be able to kind of pick up this mantle. Now, there's some really good pieces of good news in terms of the economy in Michigan and the unemployment rate and a lot of other things. But there have been some pretty big scandals and cock-ups that they've had to deal with. And I think that whoever is going to be that Republican nominee is going to have to, at some point, answer for some of that.
And to the point you touched on, and then you get into more depth in your column, about the fact that these two top Republicans in Michigan really are cut from different cloth, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Rick Snyder is a accountant turned CEO, a data-driven manager. He believes in delegation, delegating to experts, which sometimes has worked out really, really well, as in the Detroit bankruptcy with the hiring of Kevin Orr and the Jones Day team and the Conway McKenzie team. And these people pulled off something that a lot of people thought nobody could pull off in a city like Detroit. On the other hand, his experts in Flint kind of failed him, including inside his own administration. Schuette, on the other hand, I think of him as more of an old school kind of Republican. He's a relationship kind of guy. He's a glad hander. He's known for being at small events and walking around with a coffee pot and pouring coffee for people, just small talking it up. He's also very involved in Republican politics, including at the national level. I know he's going to be at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, and I think he's going to be, in fact, hosting some kind of event in advance of that. He also, interestingly enough, has said that he will support the nominee of the party, including if that's Donald Trump, whereas Rick Snyder has assiduously said, basically, I'm not involved. That also kind of speaks to the different styles of these two guys.
Looking ahead between now and when it's time for Rick Snyder to leave office, Daniel, where do you think these sour dynamics between the governor and the AG could wind up? And really, I guess, what could it mean for the state?
What could it mean for the state? Probably not a whole lot, I suspect. But I think you're going to continue to see this. Look, these are the two top elected jobs in the state of Michigan. I don't think there's any question about it. And they are two constitutionally different officers. It's not like in the United States where the attorney general works at the pleasure of the president. The attorney general in Michigan is duly elected by the people of Michigan. And he has his own responsibilities, and they take them seriously. You know, I think you're going to continue to see this. Now, privately, some people will tell you that there's no personal animosity between these people. Other people will say that there is. I think it depends on who you're talking to and how, and where, kind of where they are in the whole firmament of the relationship between the two gentlemen. But where does it take the state? I don't know. I think you're going to have Bill Schuette continue to stake out some positions that he thinks are what he needs to take. And if they are politically a little too conservative, for example, for Snyder, I think you may see Snyder push away from them a little bit.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When the Civil War broke out in April 1861, Michigan was one of the states to quickly answer the call for volunteers. In fact, when the 1st Michigan Infantry marched into Washington that May, Abraham Lincoln reportedly exclaimed, "Thank God for Michigan." This coming Saturday, July 9th, we're all invited to the state capitol to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the return of the Civil War volunteers and their battle flags, and also mark the 25th anniversary of Save the Flags. Matt Van Acker is co-chair of Save the Flags, an effort to preserve and display battle flags carried by Michigan troops. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
You know, it's interesting to think that when we're talking about the fact that this is the 150th anniversary, so 1866, so those soldiers didn't get home to Michigan for about a year after the war ended.
A few of the regiments, it took them a while to get back to their home state. Some of the regiments were sent out west for duty. Some were sent down to Texas. And, you know, there were similar ceremonies that took place across all the northern states where these men were asked to return their battle flags to the care of, you know, their respective states. And, yeah, so it took about a year for Michigan to plan the ceremony. It was an incredible event. Newspaper accounts of the time claim that there were about 70,000 people that came to Detroit to the Campus Martius for this event. If my math is right, that equals about 7% of the state's entire population that came to that event.
And the importance of turning in these flags gets us to focus on the importance of the flags. What did those flags mean to those troops during the Civil War?
Many of the flags were presented to the regiments in these grand, wonderful ceremonies before they marched off to war. The flags were presented to the men quite often by the ladies of the communities where these regiments mustered in. These men knew each other. They were real communities in the regiments. The different companies in the regiments formed in small towns and villages. So the flags, as they were presented to the regiments, were a direct link and really a reminder to them of who they were fighting for, why they were fighting for. Every time they would look at that flag in battle, they would think of that presentation ceremony and the promises that were made. I mean, they made incredible promises when they were given these flags, that the flags would, quote, become the pall, you know, the funeral garment of the regiment before they'd be surrendered. So they were important as a link to the community, but they were also terribly important on the battlefield logistically. These were Napoleonic tactics. The men knew that they were in their proper position on the field by being with what they affectionately referred to as the colors, by being with the regimental flags. Color bearers moved forward, they would follow them as they retreated. They would hold their ground when the color bearer took his staff and planted it in the ground. Every man knew their job was to defend that flag and their position to the last man.
And if the color bearer fell, then it was the job of someone else to immediately take up that flag, right?
It definitely was. Yeah, every man of the regiment knew that was their duty, to keep the flag aloft.
And the Save the Flags effort that you've been a part of, an effort to preserve and display the battle flags carried by our troops in the Civil War, this is about conservation and not restoration, right?
It is. So thank you so much for asking that, because some people don't understand the difference, understandably. What we do is we care for the flags as they are. We make sure that they don't deteriorate any more than they already have. We stabilize them. If we were to restore the flag, that would literally mean sewing up bullet holes, saber slashes, washing the blood off some of the flags. Some of the flags actually have blood stains on them from the men who died, you know, carrying them into battle. So we're conserving, we're stabilizing them, and we're making sure that they don't deteriorate, but not restoring them. And, you know, this project started about 25 years ago when our Capitol was restored, and we knew we had to make a decision to properly care for the flags that had been housed in the rotunda.
And where can people see them? How many do you have, and where can we see them?
Yeah, so we have 240 flags in our collection, 160 are Civil War. The remainder were carried by Michigan troops in the Spanish-American War and World War I. The flags are housed currently at the State Historical Center, and we have a really wonderful relationship with the folks at the Historical Center, who have very graciously afforded us space there to specially care for the collection. We do have a flag on display almost continuously. We rotate flags in and out of the display area at the museum. So if people go to see the museum, they'll actually be able to see at least one of the battle flags in our collection.
And then circling back to what we've talked about, this kind of 150th anniversary of the return of the Civil War volunteers and their battle flags that happened in 1866, what's going to happen this Saturday at the Capitol? Give us an idea.
Yeah, so we're really excited about it. This is, we consider, kind of the culminating event in the state and the nation's commemoration of the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. We have a number of things planned. We have a number of reenactors who will be coming. We have some Civil War batteries that will be bringing their cannons and actually doing demonstration firings on the lawn. We have a 1 o'clock ceremony and an official ceremony. And what we'll be kind of doing is recreating the original event. In fact, we have a number of Civil War reenactor groups that will actually be formally donating their reenactment flags to Save the Flags so we can use them for education. We're not able to take the flags on the road, so to speak, when I give talks across the state, but with these reenactment flags, I'll be able to actually take these replicas out and kind of show people what the actual flags sort of look like.
Well, it certainly seems like a wonderful, wonderful family outing for this coming Saturday starting at 10. And if you want to find out more about Save the Flags, you can do a Google search, Michigan Capitol Battle Flags, and that'll bring it all up, and you can learn more. And Matt Van Acker, it was great talking with you about your love of the Civil War. One final question. Why is it so important for us in 2016 to look back and remember the Civil War and these soldiers?
You know, preserving these flags is important, but in my mind, preserving the memory of the men and their families who made these incredible sacrifices is even more important. These folks made this country what it is today, one and united, and ending slavery. Their service and sacrifice needs to be remembered.
Matt Van Acker, thanks for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Oh, thank you so much, Cynthia. It was my pleasure.
epiphanies.
Heart of the community. The next idea.
Good ideas normally come from the collision between smaller hunches so that they form something bigger than themselves.
For a child on the autism spectrum, there can be certain challenges to learning and engaging with the world. Our latest contributors to The Next Idea are on a team from the University of Michigan. They're developing exciting new technologies to help autistic children tackle those challenges. And as we're about to hear, one of these researchers has a very personal interest in this project. Sean Ulquist is an assistant professor of architecture at the U of M Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning, and Leah Ketchinson is a postdoctoral fellow at the School of Kinesiology. Sean and Leah, so good to have you with us today on The Next Idea.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sean, you've designed a fabric, a textile, that's actually a screen, and when someone touches it, it changes colors or projects images. This technology is being called social sensory surfaces. What is that? What does that mean?
So in the context of architecture, it really has to do with like how we interact with our environment. And the idea is to be as engaged as possible with that environment. So instead of being just a backdrop, it's actually a tactile, a sensory experience, and something which can also trigger and encourage social interaction within that space. So it's meant to be, you know, much more intimate, much more dynamic interaction between those that occupy the space and the materials that define the space.
And from your perspective in kinesiology, Leah, what does it mean?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, because I think that this, I feel like, is such an interesting project to bring in kinesiology. We have found that through individualized instruction, we can really maximize results in terms of what we see with motor delays in children with autism. But this is a way to have immediate feedback. So there's an opportunity to interact with the screen and then produce some type of feedback, which I think is going to be really, really satisfying for these children interacting with the screen.
All right, so what are we talking about when we say the screen? What have you come up with?
So my background research was long in developing textile-based structures, typically more of a conventional architectural scale, so kind of, you know, a canopy, an enclosure, something like that. But the transition point was when I came to Michigan, we were able to bring in a technology which enables us to design and manufacture our own textiles. So the idea of the screen was really about the textile and all the details in which we could build into that textile.
So cool things it could do as a youngster is on it. So you've been able to turn it into kind of a playscape?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yep.
That is amazing. And Sean, your little girl inspired this research, didn't she?
Yeah, that's correct.
Tell us
about
that.
So as I was doing all this research with textile, as we started to work further with this technology where we can make our own textiles, when you make something that is a fabric, the first thing you do is touch it. You pull on it, you feel it, you know, you're
push it.
You're buying the shirt at the store. The first thing you do is you see it, but really it's about what does it feel like? How does it stretch? How does it drape on your body? And then there was kind of this, you know, really amazing moment where I was like, you know what? My daughter is a very sensory-driven, very tactile person. And I'm like, wow, I think I could connect the dots here. I was like, all this information that I've built up in terms of my research with textiles, and then all this information that I've built up in trying to understand my daughter and the things that challenge her. You know, there just came this moment of like, oh my God, I think I can make these things cross over and you know,
and really reach children on the autism
and
disorder.
Reach my daughter
disorder.
And, you
yes.
know, even reach beyond that. So.
And as you develop this playscape with this really fascinating textile, how are you seeing this, Leah, work in helping these children with ASD develop, let's say, fine and gross motor mm-hmm. skills?
Right. So we're actually just starting a research project looking at the effects of daily interaction with this screen and the outcome on fine motor movements as well as levels of physical activity. So we want to see if does sort of this daily, sort of 10 minutes a day, does it produce meaningful results in fine motor skills? So does it help the way penmanship? Will it help sort of being able to do up a button? So tasks that in children with autism are very difficult to achieve, we're going to see if whether sort of the effects of daily intervention with this environment can really produce meaningful results. We also want to look at the effect of physical activity, because we know in children with autism, they have fewer opportunities to engage in physical activity. And as a result, they really become more and more sedentary, so less physically active as they become older. So we're looking at ways in which we can sort of curb these trajectories early on in development, and we see this as an opportunity to really study the effects of these two major outcomes.
And I've got to imagine if you've got several children on this playscape, that then you're bringing in this idea of collaborative play that might not be mm-hmm. happening otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's one of the people we've been collaborating with is Anna Solomon from the Play Project, which was started here in Ann Arbor. And again, from our personal background, that was something we did, my wife and I with our daughter, we did the Play Project. So certainly it's always integrate some sort of mm-hmm. social component into the activity. And the idea is, can we generate a sensory experience which allows the child to be comfortable and confident to then start to slowly integrate what are most often the most challenging aspects in autism, which is the social interaction.
And you're both here to extend a big invitation to parents of children with autism spectrum disorder to join you for something happening this coming Sunday at the Ann Arbor Hands-On Museum. And this is what you're talking about, testing this technology with children with a wide range of ASD-related sensory issues. So what is happening on Sunday morning?
On Sunday, this is our first chance to really put it in front of the children that it's targeting, that it's built for, and just see, you know, we will be kind of capturing the means in which they're interacting, so we can kind of step back later and see, you know, are they traveling all through the playscape? Are they working just in certain areas? Because those are the most interesting. You know, there's a whole nother layer of graphics which get projected onto the surface. Are those helpful, or are they actually end up being deterrents? So I think that's what's, from an architectural perspective, that's what's really interesting about this work is there's one level to kind of create the building, create mm-hmm. the environment, bring the materials together, and you know, the structure stands on its own. But it really has no meaning until we actually watch the kids play with it, see how, you know, what is the true value of the technology.
And we should note, space is limited, but you can sign up for this coming Sunday morning play session for children with autism spectrum disorder at the Ann Arbor Hands-On Museum by going to myturncommunity.org. Leah, when you think about the work that you and this team are doing today, what is your hope for the future?
So we know really the core deficits in children with autism are really in the social and communication domain. But I think from our perspective within the kinesiology world, we're really seeing that with the literature coming out, the motor domain are really among the first huge biomarkers that we feel are really delayed. And this is as early as 4 to 6 months old. We can start seeing low muscle tone and some asymmetry in motor movements. So this is, I think, our opportunity to provide a really unique perspective in addressing some of the challenges that we see in the motor aspect. But also, we really think that this is an opportunity to address the motor domain as well as the social domain, which really right now is considered one of the core deficits. So like Sean was sort of speaking about, we want to see if this environment can facilitate some type of peer interaction that really wouldn't be noticeable on a playground or in a community recreational sort of sports league. So we hope to sort of create an environment that's comfortable enough for them to engage with one another.
Sean, you certainly see this in your life with your daughter, but I'm sure you're looking outward too and thinking how great it would be to have this technology really click and be able to put these playscapes in schools all over the world.
That would be wonderful. I mean, I think it definitely starts from an understanding of my daughter, but also trying to learn more about her through developing these kind of architectures and technology. And of course, the hope is that it's, you know, extensible beyond that. I mean, that's, I think, one of the unique challenges, but also is built into our approach is, you know, this common phrase of when you've met one person with autism, you've met that one person with autism. It's very hard to kind of translate from one case to another. So, in the technology we're really trying to build, and this is, you know, our experience at the Hands-On Museum upcoming this weekend is our first chance to see this, kind of build in that level of variability so that each child can kind of find their comfortable place. They can, you know, find the one little corner that's comfortable for them or the color of the graphics that's comfortable for them and then be able to go from there.
Once again, the private, less stimulating time for children with autism spectrum disorder to experience the Ann Arbor Hands-On Museum and get out there and play on the Sensory Playscapes exhibit is this Sunday, July 10th, from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. You can go to the Hands-On Museum's Facebook page, and you can look for My Turn, a sensory-friendly Sunday, and also sign up at myturncommunity.org. Sean Ahlquist with the U of M Taubman School of Architecture and Leah Ketchinson School of Kinesiology. We want to thank you so much for being part of The Next Idea.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What's that sound you hear? It might be Wolverine fans chortling and Spartan fans growling as ESPN unveils its future power rankings for college football. Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubacon is here with us. And first, a bit of history, John. Over the past, let's say, 4 years, what has Michigan State football accomplished?
Just about everything you can in college football, short of a national title. They've won several, of course, Big Ten titles, division titles, only 2 years out of the last six where they shut out of any titles, which is pretty amazing. They've been to three BCS bowls. They've won four bowls. They've won two of those BCS bowls. They've gotten to the four-team playoff. They've done everything again except winning a national title.
And Michigan football.
They have done everything but get kicked out of the Big Ten. Obviously, in 2011, Brady Hoke had a great season at 11-2. And last year, of course, Jim Harbaugh went 10-3, winning a big-time bowl against a Florida, good Florida team. So two great seasons out of that batch, but a lot of bad ones.
And here comes ESPN with its annual college football future power rankings, peering into the future and predicting which programs are going to thrive and succeed. And what do we get? Michigan in fifth place and at number 10, Michigan State. Your thoughts?
It's good for hype, of course, I think. We're talking about it now, aren't we?
So true.
That worked. Look, we're all just guessing here. Clearly, I'm not one of the pollsters here.
Sure.
This is Harbaugh's first year. The question in Michigan State's case is, how long will D'Antonio stay? I think ESPN is betting that Harbaugh's got more years left in him at Michigan than D'Antonio does at Michigan State. That's the bet there. Furthermore, Michigan's got most of its team coming back this year, where Michigan State is losing most of its team to graduation, the NFL, Connor Cook, their star quarterback. Nonetheless, this is exactly the kind of thing that gets Michigan its reputation for arrogance and Michigan State its reputation for bitterness. And it's good fodder on both sides, I suppose you'd say. Look, Michigan State has made a living out of eating disrespect. This is great fodder for them.
Should the Irish be in a higher place than the Spartans? They were number 9 and the Spartans were number 10.
I think they're basing that on the finances of the whole thing, not necessarily football success, but the fact that Notre Dame is a money machine. They don't share their money with the Big Ten.
That's true.
Good contract. They get to keep it all.
And speaking of Notre Dame, a very popular rivalry appears to be back on.
One of the most popular in the nation, Michigan-Notre Dame, on not just down the road, but 2018, only 2 years away. That is very fast work by Jack Swarbrick, the Notre Dame AD, and, of course, the new AD at Michigan, Ward Manuel, which apparently does prove the point that Dave Brandon, not Swarbrick, was the sticking point in the Michigan-Notre Dame rivalry ending a few years ago.
In an ugly way, as you describe in your book.
Very ugly way, and Swarbrick was the author of that, let's be clear. Swarbrick handed Dave Brandon the envelope with a few hours to go. Before the first kickoff there.
We're breaking up with you.
Breaking up with you. And we're going to take two of the next three home games, which, by the way, are worth $4 million each. Those are huge. So Michigan got a bit screwed on that one, but it appears that he felt Michigan's going to break up with him first. Junior high school dating. Oh, yeah? I break up with you.
So all seems to be forgiven and back on track for 2018.
It seems to be based on personalities, not the actual schools.
And we can't let you go today without noting the Tigers finally did it.
What did they finally do, you're asking? Cleveland Indians. They had lost 11 straight to division rival Cleveland Indians. They won finally on Thursday, so now they're 1-11 against Cleveland. Here's a fun fact for you. If Detroit had won only 6 of the 12 games against Cleveland, they'd be in first place by a good chunk and Cleveland a distant second.
Ooh.
As it is, it's just the opposite now based on one series. I've never seen one team have such a big problem with one team. That's Detroit and Cleveland. That's their only problem.
That's wild. Now, you have been so-so about the Tigers so far this year, John. Any change of heart? Any warming of your lukewarm heart?
1 out of 11, Cindy, is not going to do it for me. Kudos, Tigers. Congratulations. They play them again, the Indians, in September for 3 more games. That could decide the division.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubake. And as always, thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
We continue now with our series, Minding Michigan, where we explore mental health issues in our state. In 2014, Michigan became the first state to create a set of detailed guidelines for treating people who are addicted to heroin and other opioids. The guidelines were praised by many in the treatment community as being clear, understandable, and taking addiction treatment in our state to the next level. With us now via Skype is the doctor who wrote those guidelines. At the time, he was based in Grand Rapids. Recently, he became Senior Medical Director for Education and Policy at the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers in New Jersey. Dr. Corey Waller, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What was the overall goal of the guidelines you wrote?
Well, initially, this came about as we sat down and had a conversation at the state level with the employees for the group that deals with all of things addiction and behavioral health within the state. And when I asked them as a provider, well, can you point me to what it is that we do that needs to check the box of how it's done right and how you know that what you're paying for is a good value and how we know that our patients are getting good care? And I got a couple of shrug shoulders and I don't knows. And with that, we started working with the state with a group of people from around the state that work in treatment to identify ways in which we could start that. And the first one was really we needed a set of guidelines that were evidence-based and pulled together the best guidelines from around the country as well as new literature so that we could really approach this group of patients knowing that we're doing the right thing and helping the state to level set the approach that they would take for what they should be paying for.
So the idea is let's get everybody in the state kind of on the same page as far as best practices.
Right. And this is something that had not been done in addiction medicine, where it had been done in many other areas, such as internal medicine or cardiology or endocrinology. These are areas that have guidelines and have the approach that should be taken. And so payers, such as the Medicaid program within the state or for partners such as Priority Health or Blue Cross Blue Shield, they know what they're paying for, but this was an area that we didn't know. And for those who don't know, in Michigan, like many other states, we have what we call a carve-out, which means that we have separated the health insurance program for behavioral health from that for physical health. And that includes addiction. And so this is a completely separate entity within the state that needed to be guided to what we can do to improve the outcomes of patients and do that really at a lower cost.
Dr. Waller, these guidelines were unveiled in September 2014, so coming up on 2 years since they were unveiled, how effective do you think the guidelines have proven to be in that time?
Well, I think they've done exactly what they were supposed to do, which is started to set up to where now we're codifying, meaning we're putting the language of the guidelines into the contracts that are signed between the state of Michigan and the people that provide the care and deliver the care within the communities themselves. And so not only is this a, well, this is nice to do, but now people and the prepaid inpatient health plans, which is who divvies out the cash in the different counties, they're going to be held to accountable for living up to those contractually, not just as a, I hope so, or I want them to, but now they'll have a contract that has the core elements of those guidelines in it that they have to, you know, provide that care.
And what does that ultimately mean for patients and for the people who love them?
Well, what it means is that when you go in to get help, that you're going to get the best help possible no matter where you are in Michigan. It's also helped us to define what I call treatment deserts, these areas of Michigan that don't have any treatment capable physicians or providers in those areas to deliver that care. And once someone is contractually obligated to deliver it, it is a really important thing for them to go find it and to be able to obtain that care. So right now we're in the process of ramping up the availability. And for whether you live in Iron Mountain or in the middle of Detroit, you should be able to have access to treatment for addictive disorders.
So you're saying we're ramping up, not there yet, but you're seeing progress?
Absolute progress. And even in areas that, such as Grand Rapids, where I was, we've tripled the number of people who can deliver addiction care over the last 3 years. And that's happening in numbers of other areas within the state where they are identifying this as a core need, not just because of the guidelines, but mainly because this is the number one cause of injury-related death in the state of Michigan, overdose. And because this is such a critical crisis happening right now within our healthcare system that is preventable with good treatment, everybody is rushing. And so having guidelines set up so that they know what to build and how to build it has become really important, because now they're building on an evidence-based lattice rather than just making it up as they go.
So in a sense now, there are guidelines that spell out mild or moderate or severe levels of addiction and then plugs in what kind of medication or behavioral therapy that science shows is the most effective for that level.
Correct. And that's you can't say that enough, that this is the evidence that has shown this. This is not a my opinion piece. This is not a document of what I hope would happen to patients. This has been evaluated and vetted by many individuals within the treatment community in Michigan. Has been seen by criminal justice all the way to the executive branch, to the people on the ground delivering the care, and patients and their families. I've gotten feedback from all of them to make sure that we built a document that could be helpful for all of those.
Dr. Waller, as we speak now, what do you believe are the most promising medications available for treating opiate addiction?
Well, right now we have a number of medications that we can use, one of which is naltrexone, and this is an injectable medication that blocks opioids. Now, this is extremely helpful for patients who have high motivation levels and want to get better, for blocking the opioid where they can't use heroin or they can't take opioid pills. It's not for everybody, and for those patients, we have to assess whether we could use a medication called buprenorphine. Now, this comes in many different forms. It comes in three different oral forms, and now the FDA just recently approved the first implantable version of this, which lasts for 6 months. And then we have the one that is emotionally maligned by many people, which is interesting to me that people have such an emotional connection to a medication. But methadone still has the best long-term outcomes of any of the other treatment modalities for opioid use disorder. So those medications should be made available for everyone. Not just, well, this is the med I use, or this is the other med that I use. They need to have access to all three of those medications so that we can apply it to the individual so that they can get the right treatment at the right time, you know, and in the right place.
I'm speaking with addiction medicine specialist Dr. Corey Waller, who is the doctor who wrote the guidelines that Michigan now has, becoming the first state to have a detailed guideline for treating people who are addicted to opioid drugs. This addiction, doctor, I don't need to tell you, is such a rising problem across the country, certainly here in Michigan. I'm wondering, how focused do you believe our elected leaders and our state and public health officials are on addressing the opiate addiction problem?
Well, I do have to say our state has been relatively out in front, one, by adopting, you know, these guidelines before any other state, no matter who it is. It's not New York or California, the places that are usually out front, but Michigan really was out in front. And so Nick Lyon and his predecessor were really motivated to get this done. And then shortly after that, the governor's task force that was developed for prescription drug misuse and abuse, really, and I was on that task force as well, solidified this forward motion of getting it right. And the executive order that just came down from the governor stating that they wanted to create not only just the task force that was there, but create the commission to allow this to be an ongoing committee that has to report back to the governor, that has to make sure that the things that were found to be most effective from the task force are implemented rapidly and consistently. So I would say overall, the state and the Office of the Recovery-Oriented Systems of Care, which lives at the Department of Health and Human Services, is doing a wonderful job. And so it is getting better on a rapid pace, much better than many other states. In fact, most other states.
The folks at the Department of Health and Human Services certainly have had a lot on their plate with the Flint water crisis. Is there any concern among the treatment community that the Flint water crisis has diverted at least attention and energy, if not actual dollars, away from the opioid addiction problem?
I think that has absolutely happened. And it's not to state that what happened in Flint is not important. I mean, goodness gracious. I mean, you know, having heavy metals in the water and having, you know, that type of an issue happen to a city is devastating. But for the price paid for the one city, the entire state is still not addressing the number one cause of injury-related death, which is overdose. And we did see energy and focus slip out of the legislation about this at that time because they needed to get their hands around what was going on in Flint. And I think we've done a good job, and it's going to take them many years to fix that in a permanent way. But at the same time, we cannot take our eyes off the ball about what is causing the most harm to the most people in the state and refocus on this so that we don't lose the ground that we gained.
Now it's been almost 2 years. Is it time to update and revise the guidelines you wrote?
Yeah, we're actively doing that right now because we have had some new medications and there's been some new information coming out from the behavioral therapy side. So that's happening as we speak. And actually, we're currently working on, and I'm working on with DHHS, guidelines for the treatment of alcohol use disorder, which, by the way, is still the number one addiction in the country, but at the same time doesn't have the severe rapid mortality rate. So they are very excited about moving forward and updating those with new medications and new behavioral therapies. And as importantly, how do you pay for that treatment so that you get the best bang for your buck?
One of the comments about the guidelines when you wrote them and when they were released is that they are very clear, very understandable. And even if you're not a member of the provider community, so let's say you're a concerned parent, you'll get something out of reading these guidelines. Where can people go to find them, Doctor?
At this point, they should be on the website for the state of Michigan and under DHHS.
What do you believe Michigan's next step needs to be to really tackle, as you say, the number one cause of injury-related death? What should the next step be?
Well, I think the first thing is a wholesale effort to really take care of the stigma associated with addiction, because without that, people will not do the effective things that we know need to happen because they'll have an emotional context to the disease rather than just treating it as a chronic neurobiological disorder. Once we work on that aspect of stigma, we need to make sure that all of the medications that have good evidence behind them are made available to patients and that we identify the areas that are treatment deserts and expand those treatments so that those patients in those areas have access to the evidence-based treatments that they deserve.
Do you believe that you will see a day when you can truly say, yes, we have eliminated the danger of opiate addiction?
I don't think we'll ever be able to truly eliminate it, but I think we can identify it, we can prevent it, and we can treat it when it occurs. Opioids are one of the oldest things on the planet that we've used and that have medicinal value, and they're never going to go completely away, at least in my lifetime. And so because of that, there will always be some level of risk, but we do know that poor evaluation of how you prescribe these medications to patients absolutely leads to risk. It leads to the extra pill in the closet that's taken by the teenager. It leads to the relapse on a person who has an opioid use disorder and then had surgery. It leads to the accidental death of a grandmother from it not being prescribed properly. We know those things, and now we have to, you know, put together appropriate pain treatment guidelines so that we can prevent as best we can the risk to those that have addiction in their family or in their genetic profile. And then followed by that is making sure that if it does happen or when it does happen, that we can aggressively and in an evidence-based and scientifically based way treat that patient to the best of our ability.
Addiction medicine specialist Dr. Corey Waller, who wrote Michigan's guidelines for treating opiate addiction. It was great to talk with you, Dr. Waller. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ali Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Our contributors include Daniel Raisel, Ryan Grimes, and Kate Summers. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. michiganbusiness.org.